Summer, 1971. I was a ritual-loving teenager then, living with my boyfriend in one of the makeshift huts on Bill's land, deep in a shady little valley in Napa, California. Every day, I'd hike up out of the valley, up to the mountain, up to the most majestic oak tree, and there I'd sit under the twisted branches, throwing my voice around, setting off a cascade of ricocheting echoes in the valley. There was a party on Bill's land. Everyone came out of their huts for the occasion, and there was a feast for the eyes and treats for the taste buds, and for dessert, psilocybin mushrooms. So many people, too many people, so many people, too many people. I long to be alone. Gotta go, gotta go, gotta go, gotta sing on the mountain under my tree. Near a rickety bridge that covered a bubbling brook. She's very pregnant. He's holding his guitar, but not playing. Bickering, they've been bickering. I don't want to interrupt. I just smiled a sheepish grin and then stepped down to the bridge. Looking down, careful, careful to keep my balance. But when I looked up, I couldn't believe.
How atmospheric. It's incredible. Hi, Seema, you can talk in here. So, thank you all for coming. This is our celebration of our
CD.
Hey, CD, right. Where Were You Then? CD. That's a culmination of a long time of working with each other, and
I saw you a lot. I know you a long time ago. On stage.
Yeah. In 1985 in Switzerland, right? We met at Phil Niblock's place.
February 2000,
that's right.
I go, huh?
Okay, you're going to the piano now, and we're gonna start our first song. And it's very special to see some of the most important people in my life here. I'm not gonna tell you who you are, but the musicians! Oh, luckily you get to read about them in the bio tonight. But we have Jason Huang. Loves him. Danny Tunick. Marika, like Eureka Hughes. Nicole Federici. Jessica Pavone. And you heard Dave Hofstra playing bass on that last piece. He's actually worked in all the permutations of this project. And where's Danny Tunick? Hey, Danny. Hi. And my angel, Daphne Naftali. I love you, Simo. Yes, I do. Should I have seen you? Never should you have looked at me so. And never should I have whispered in your ear. Never should you have called me. Never should I have heard your voice, and never should you have come so very close. Kissed me like you did. Never should I have squiggled. Never should you have wiggled like that. And never should you have taken me to bed. Never should you have loved me. Never should I have loved you back. And never should we have walked the line. Never should we have waited. Never should we have said all those nevers. And never, no, never, never again. Never, never, never. My two favorite girls in the world are sitting in the front seat. I'm sorry for embarrassing you, Katya and Maya, but I just can't help it. Okay, this piece, Simo and I actually composed it back in 2000, and it was just a faux French and piano. And then it just seemed we needed to put this story to it. So Simo arranged it for the strings and, right? And here it is in this new permutation. Maxime Cardon. I'm thinking about Maxime Cardon. She was French from Paris, but I met her in Amsterdam. We were both models at the Academy of Art. She was new the first time I saw her. She had a face like a Madonna. Her eyebrows were plucked. She had brown bedroom eyes and silky maroon-headed hair with short bangs. Her front teeth were large, but she mostly kept her full lips closed. Her neck was tall, and she moved so delicately. Her long arms moved so gracefully. Her breasts hung low, but the nipples pointed upward. She was short-waisted with wide hips. Her slender legs seemed to start way high up. Somehow, she reminded me of a horse. Yes, horse, cheval in French. Much more romantic than horse. Cheval, cheval. I was 20 and she was 23, and she used to ride me on the back of her bike. We'd stop at the outdoor markets at closing time, and we'd pick out fruit and vegetables from the reject pile. And on my good day, she said, I even find steak on the street. We found an abandoned factory to squat. It was filled with mildewed furniture and used syringes and other unmentionable things. And it took us a long time to clear it out, but somehow the movement we made as we cleared it up was like some kind of new choreography. The place was magnifique in the end, and we took our meals on a platform covered with a burgundy rug, and we sat in two stuffed armchairs as though we were in a Vermeer painting, and we found everything on the street. We had no electricity, but we made even the most simple meal beautiful. and fresh herring and fresh figs, and sometimes her parents sent us fine champagne. Our makeshift dining platform was set over a trap door to prevent our downstairs neighbors from coming into our place again. 10 guys with long, scraggly hair lived down there. They were from Italy. It was very dark. And they liked to sew while snorting white stuff in the glow of black light. One day, Maxime and I saw two of them panhandling on the Dom Square. They were wearing bell bottoms that they made from our missing brocade bedspreads, pom poms and all. They were really quite domestic, and they sang O Solo Mio while they cooked pasta in big garbage cans in front of the house. I'm not kidding. So this next piece, I met this guy, Heinz. He was really attractive on the Dom Square. Lots was going on there then. And at the same time, I had just heard about Documenta, this Biennale of International Modern Art. So I had an excuse to visit him. Did I have an excuse to visit Documenta? Anyway, I went hitchhiking on the highway to go and see him and Documenta, and this is what happened. I got picked up by these two men in a dark blue Mercedes Benz. I was hitchhiking on the highway, and it was pouring rain, and I mean, there was something bad that happened to me when I was hitchhiking in San Francisco the year before, but it wasn't gonna happen to me this time. This was Holland, you know, Donkey Bell and all that. Anyway, I got in, and pretty soon, I realized that the men weren't Dutch after all. They were German. They were elegant. Their dark blue suits matched the car, and they had these accents. One of them was bald, and he was at least 70, and the other was at least 50. You know where they must have been in World War II? I'm Jewish, but not really. No one ever talked about that kind of thing in my neighborhood. Not even the couple who had these numbers on their arms. They own the corner grocery store. Anyway, I told the man that my name was Shelley Hirsch. They must have known it was a Jewish name. I showed them the little paper with Heinz's address written on it. He lived in Kassel. I met him on the Dom Square, and he looked like the other strong, quiet types I was attracted to, except his hair was blonde. I was so nervous. Suddenly, we're going off the highway, and we stopped at the address I had given them. They must have known. I mean, it was the younger man got out of the car and rang a bell. Where was Heinz? The man got back in the car, and they said they were gonna take care of me. And then we drove and drove to a forest. Now I love nature, but it was after the rain and everything was dripping. It reminded me of those Grimm's fairy tales. I love them, but they were brutal. We kept driving through droplets of rain, and then they pulled over to a house. It looked like a gingerbread house, but they let me out so gracefully. A woman came to the door, and she had a dirndl dress on, and clouds and hairy legs like I did when I worked in the donut shop in San Francisco. They told me to come sit down at a beautiful wooden table, and there was a fireplace, and they ordered potato soup for me. I loved it. There were little frankfurters in it. And after I ate, they said they couldn't just leave me there. They would take me back to Heinz's house. How could they be so nice? Home, so they rang the bell of a neighbor and asked if I could wait there until Heinz came home.
He came down.
Ooh.
He
moved like a gazelle, like yogis I'd seen.
His foot had high ceilings.
Drinking tea from porcelain bowls. Then
I turned to see
these women, 10 of them on the marble place. They were all made of plaster, and none of them had any heads.
I knew he was gay.
But I thought gay men liked women. Anyway, it still felt, you know, the fear factor had already dissipated. And then, just as the record had ended, it was pictures at an exhibition. I heard some sound. It was Heinz walking up the stairs, very slowly. Slowly. I grabbed my knapsack and walked to the door. I stopped to put on my shoes. They hadn't yet dried from that walk in the rain. I opened the door. There was Heinz. He looked different than when I met him on the Dam Square in Amsterdam. He looked very pale. He didn't seem so happy to see me, but I followed him up the stairs. He opened the door. There were graying sheets hung sloppily across the windows. A small wooden table filled with cigarette butts and packs of cigarettes. I didn't really know what to do. Heinz just walked into the other room and sat down in a ratty, stuffed chair. He was clearly very ill. I asked if there was anything I could do to help. He didn't speak much English. I told him I would take care of him. He just got into bed. I don't know where I slept that night. I guess I slept with him. But I do know that the next day, I headed out to Documenta to see some modern art alone. It was so weird. I didn't want to see all of those American advertisements for Marlboro cigarettes and beer. I don't know. Maybe they were some Andy Warhol prints I was looking at, but I left Documenta after an hour. I stopped for a while to watch some ducks waddling up the canal, and then I went back to Heinz's house. There was a putrid smell in the flat, and Heinz looked even worse than when I had left. I don't know how I knew, but he was going cold turkey. I decided I would just stay there and take care of him. I was there for what seemed like days. The TV was always on. His eyes were mostly closed. The Olympics were on TV. It was taking place in Munich that year. Munich was only a few hours away from where we were. There was a little stool beside the bed. I think I had just gone to sit on it when I heard the shots and saw the Israeli athletes being killed on TV. September 5th, 1972. I don't know when I left and hitchhiked back to Amsterdam. I imagine that I waited till Heinz was okay. The subjective nature of memory. My friend Dan told me that I couldn't have seen it happen on TV. Maybe I was just sitting there and I heard the newscasters burst on to say what was happening, but we all remember and have pictures in our own particular way. But I do remember Julius very well, perfectly.
Julius. They tied him up. His body left in the cold. He wouldn't sit still, and that drove them crazy. When he saw me, he wanted so. Just to follow me down to where we'd been before we were found out. But they wouldn't let him go, and so whenever I could, I would untie him at night. In the light of the silvery moon, he'd bounce along in sync with me. Then he'd run off and wind up in some dirty mess. But he always came right back and stayed at my side. That's loyalty, no need for words we shared. Quality time. I loved him, and if I could have, I would have taken him with me. But I couldn't offer enough room to roam, and he was already part of a family. They gave him bones and lots of other trees. Ah, Julius, I can still remember your beige bristly hair, your hot panting breath, and the feel of your sandpaper tongue, your excited cries. It was all so uncomplicated, Julius, and I like it like that. Julius.
for years and years, when Mom was nude and in some kind of standing position. The layers of her flesh reminded me of a huge wedding cake, the kind with lots of tears. When I arrived for that visit on May the 4th, she was spread out on the bed. Her skin looked smooth, so smooth, like a white whale. And her feet were like twisted fins. Her knees were swollen to an improbable width. And those hands that I like to think of as porcelain wings had little black hill-like growths on them. She was in a morphine-induced stupor, but was nonetheless easily agitated. Mom shared a room in the nursing home with Lillian, a woman of 92 who hadn't left her bed in years for anything other than the very basic necessities. Lillian liked me because I lived in Manhattan. She loved Manhattan. Lillian had luminescent skin, but she wasn't a nice woman. When Mom moved into the nursing home, she needed a place to store her outfits. There were at least 30 of them, largely mixed and matched polyester ones. But Lillian had only two dresses and a robe in her closet. She wouldn't let Mom store them there. You had to pass Lillian's bed when you went to see Mom. There was only a curtain between them, and Mom's bed was by the window. She loved being near the window. On May 5th, 2005, in the afternoon, the doctor came in to check on Mom. He told me she could live in a current state for weeks, or maybe she'd pull through. She'd surprised everyone so many times before. I was still with her in the evening at around 7:15 when she finally seemed to be resting peacefully. I called my sister Randy and said I would leave earlier than I had planned. Would she come to get me at 8:30? The usually kind attendant, who had a thick Haitian patois, went to change her at 7:30. I said, no, please, she hadn't slept this peacefully in days. But those were the orders. 7:30 was the time to change her. I watched very closely as she turned my mother from side to side. My eyes scanned every inch of her body. Her white skin had so many bruises on it, and you can still see the light freckles in many places. Her pubic hair was curly and very sparse. Her pendulous breasts were still enormous. I'd seen her nude many times before, but it had been a long time since she could experience the luxury of vanity regarding her body. Still, she never left her room in her wheelchair without makeup and a matching ensemble. When the attendant was nearly finished changing her, Mom became agitated, her body so tense, she started making extremely contorted gestures. She was struggling to find her breath, and horrible creaking sounds were coming out of her. Please, please put on the oxygen mask. She can't breathe, I cried. Lillian could not see anything on Mom's side of the drawn curtain, but she called out, get a doctor! Why is there no doctor? I ran to get someone to help. It seemed like forever before the nurses came in and put on the mask, but it got worse.
and worse and worse. The gasping intensified. Her face was twisted into a position I'd never seen before, not in real life. Why can't somebody help? What's happening? What's happening? The attendant stood there very calmly, very still, her hands clasped in front of her.
You know.
But I didn't know. Not then. I tried to hold my mother, to sing her favorite song, the one I never wanted to sing for her. The minute you walked in the door, I could tell you was a man of distinction. We'll be expanded. My sister Randy arrived to pick me up punctually at 8:30. She's an emergency room nurse. She always carries her stethoscope. She put it on. She listened to our mother's heart. At 8:35, Randy pronounced her dead. I don't remember them taking her body away. And I don't know when I saw the book on the cluttered nightstand beside her empty bed. It was covered in embossed faux leather, a paisley pattern. It was kind of beautiful, even though it was plastic. I opened it. I was surprised when I looked through the pages and saw that the book was a collection of rather hardcore Victorian pornography. And there was a very amorous letter placed in the book, which had been written by a lover who she hadn't seen for many years. I took the letter and the book with me. I have them still.
Say something about that piece. Simo and I were in Berlin, and I asked him to play me something that he'd been working on, and he played that music, and I heard 20 seconds of it, and I said, wait, I have a story, and I've been hearing it with those chords and that timing, and I said, just record me, just, I don't want to hear the whole thing, I just want to do it, and that became the piece, and then we brought these people into it. And you can hear Dave on the record.
Your fear of my leaving was stronger than your love. You hammered me so hard, I swallowed my words.
But oh, your skin, I always gave in. Your kisses all over me made me sing, but I could not speak. You needed me to say that I would always, always stay, but you could not hear me. Your volume was up so high. Please turn it down, I begged. I told you I was up in the air, so you went back online to the site where we met. You denied it when I asked you. You used the name that I had given you, Woody Allen Belmondo. You were smart, but rarely slow. And so quick to find another again. When you came clean, I said goodbye and cried. But you sent me 30 text messages saying, declare yourself to me and I am all yours. Even though you had already taken her to bed. 3 days in a row, I took you back. But how could I trust someone whose new screen name was Secrets 07? This next piece is also a memory from the 70s. I know, but I don't want to embarrass her, but for one of the most beautiful people I know.
Looking through the lacy leaf trees at the water below. Oh. I was flying with my friend Kathy Ray on our holiday. She was reading Chinese poetry from an anthology. Soon after we arrived at her friend's home, she played piano while I danced. I'm so glad that nobody else was there to see me. We took a walk through a forest. She was wearing a t-shirt with clouds, and she fell into some mud so very lovely. Seeing clouds and sky and earth all together on her chest. And when we got out of the forest, the sun had already set, and there were men filling the streets, and they were wearing high black hats, and they had on long black coats and long, long curls. And then we came upon a sign that said, "Welcome to Bethlehem, Bethlehem, New Hampshire." Whoa.
This is a piece that we actually played before in another group, and it's on the CD.
Special people here, and usually I'm, you know, just moving around. Hi, John. Okay. All right. One. You know how you steer your body, your gaze, to find the view that's so sublime. It presses the nerve that sets off your tears. In Italian, ricordo means I remember. The body's a camera recording the light. Remember how
how we mind the light. That first day, you wanted to take me to the countryside. We were driving when suddenly you pulled the car off the road, took my hand, led me through a clearing in the woods to a lake filled with lily pads. And in that deep, velvet voice you said, "Schau das Licht an, look at the moon." I sat and watched you swim naked, you beckoned me in. I remember how you sipped the glittering droplets of water off my shoulders. Drinking the light, standing on a soft bed of fallen needles, we appeared as a pair of silhouettes on the trunk of a huge spruce tree. One silhouette above the other, undulating slowly. We were guiding the light. Rows of evergreens, will you go and sit there until the long diagonal spear of sun pierces through the trees and down to your golden body? Just so, don't move. Oh, grow a grin like a thick stalk sunflower, and you smile that grin, turning tonight. Your head buried between my legs, I sigh watching storm clouds in the distance. You said if you could watch clouds on TV, you'd never turn it off. We brush against fuzzy pillows and shapes of metallic light, flash like lightning. Boat and I'll take the red, paddling towards the sun. Long, strong strokes, slowly bobbing, as easy as floating. Star-shaped shards of light jump up like big fish through the surface of the water. On the pier above, not until the sun illuminated them. I had to lift each glistening thread over my head one by one with my left hand to make way for the kayak. I paddled through with the right. Remember the light, your recorder. Thank you, Jason Wang, Nicole Federici, Marika Hughes, Jason Pavone, Jessica Pavone, Dave Hofstra, Janet Higgins, Daphne Napoli, Simo, Simo. And thank you very much to the people at Roulette, especially Stephen over there, and Amanda, and Jim, and all the people that work at the office. I really hope you come again to Roulette. And maybe you'd like to buy the CD out front and talk to us a little bit after.
Carousels. I was talking with the people she'd been talking about. Everybody wanted to catch the ring. They were moving very slowly, trying to find it as she spun around. Then bolted, jumped off the horses, marking time. She turned on a dime. That day she was agitated. All shook up, shaken. She was never the same way twice. She had to keep looking for traces, and this has gone out of nowhere. It hasn't been.
the horse appeared in the backyard. She wanted to ride it, but saw it flee into the night. She turned again on a dime. Her line was dropped. She picked it up, flew away, caught the moon, made a wood, caught it all. The moon, the one.
I feel it.
The two, the blue, the blue one, the blue two, like her eyes.
To the hall and we'll see what happens.
Yesterday's child, yes, yesterday's child. See the stars, look at them, disappear, flick, switch, look again. Imagine, 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 imagine. Circling in your mind, yesterday's beginning never happened at all.
Me down, kissed my cheeks, grabbed the ring, put it on the ring.